book of Judges is that time period between Moses and between the kings. And it's about 400, well, actually between Joshua and the kings, about 400 years. And it's that roller coaster time in Israel's history where they follow the Lord for a while, and then the spiritual leader dies, and then everything dies, and they go worship other gods, and they go, boom, and they crash. And then God has to do something to wake them up, and usually it's something like he brings in a foreign nation to rule over them for a while, and to wake them up, to kind of rattle their cage a little bit. And then once they realize how miserable they are without the Lord, they cry out to God, and then God raises up another person, and he brings deliverance, and then they kick out the bad guys, and everything's wonderful for a little while. And then the spiritual leader dies, and the people walk away from the Lord, and they go, boom. And it's over and over and over. We see this cycle throughout the book of Judges. In Judges chapter 7, we're just shooting right of the roller coaster. We're just starting to head up in the life of a man named Gideon. We did a little bit of Gideon last week. We'll do a little bit more this morning, and we'll finish him off tonight. Sorry, we're not going to even get to the exciting stuff tonight. I think we're getting to the exciting stuff, but this is like total, you know, suspense. You better come back to tonight, see the end of the story kind of thing. So I tell you, I'm really sneaky here. Okay. God called Gideon to deliver Israel from the terrorizing Midianites. Every year at the harvest time, the Midianites would come swooping in. After the Israelites had harvested their crops, they'd come in and... We get the idea from that Gideon is a timid, fearful man. Maybe even a skeptical one. We saw last week that when he made a decision to follow the Lord and start his ministry, it started with tearing down his father's altars to Baal, which was one of the idols. And it started with getting rid of that junk in his family. Then Gideon blows a horn, and it blows a trumpet. He gathers an army. And we're going to see today he gathered 32,000 men. That's pretty cool size army. That's okay. That's pretty decent size. Of course, he was facing 135,000. But, hey, you know, we can do this. We're the mighty Israelites. We can do this. 32,000, that's pretty cool. And then at the end of the chapter, of chapter 6, Gideon's still not quite sure. And he does this fleece thing, where he says, you know, God, I'm not really, really, I really want to do what you want, but I want to know that it's you. And so he says, you know, God, you know, how about, I'm going to lay out this sheepskin, and in the morning, could you have the sheepskin be wet and the ground be dry? And sure enough, the next morning, Gideon picks up the sheepskin, wrings it out, a full bowl of water was soaking this thing. And then Gideon gets to thinking, he says, well, you know, I'm not really, really, really sure. Could you just like, one more thing? How about tomorrow the sheepskin be dry and the ground be wet? And sure enough, the next morning, that's exactly the way it was. And so, we're at this place in chapter 7, beginning of chapter 7, where Gideon has his army. And now, he knows that God's leading him. God's directing. We pick it up in chapter 7, verse 1. Then Jerubbaal, who is Gideon, and all the people that were with him rose up early and pitched beside the well of Herod, so that the host of the Midianites were on the north side of them by the hill of Moreh in the valley. Now, we mentioned last week, Gideon gets a nickname when he tears down his father's altar. His dad nicknames him Jerubbaal, which means the guy who fights with Baal. This kind of a cool little nickname. And so you're going to see this in and out. You're going to see him being called this, the guy who fights with Baal. It's just, this is his nickname. And so he and all of his people, they got up and they camped out. Their first camping spot was by this well or the spring or fountain of Herod, which is a very good, aptly named place, because this the name Herod in Hebrew means fearful or trembling. Yes, this is Gideon. This is Gideon. He says, okay, everybody wants to follow me. You know, let's camp out in a trembling place. You know, and so that's where they are. And kind of the way that the scene is set, they're up in the northern part of Israel. They're just south and just west of the Sea of Galilee. There's a little valley there called the Valley of Jezreel. There's a river that runs through it. And on the south side is where Gideon and his men are. On the north side, up on this hill, is... And so they're all gathered together. Verse 2, and the Lord said unto Gideon, the people that are with thee are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel vaunt themselves against me, or boast themselves, or become proud, or glorify themselves against me, saying, mine own hand hath saved me. Now, I don't know how this hits Gideon. I would be a little discouraged. I mean, it's like, you know, God, I got 32,000. You know, we're still outnumbered something like 5-1. You know, it's okay. It's okay. You know, we'll... And God says, no, you've got too many. You've got too many. There's some things I've been chewing on with this. One of the thoughts is this. God specializes in the impossible. God specializes in the impossible. I think that for some of you, the thing you need to hear this morning is just that. That God specializes in impossible things. When Abraham was told that he was going to have a kid, he was 100 years old. His wife was 90 years old. They're really, 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 really old. And God says, you're going to have a kid. Well, you mean you? You mean me? Her? Me? Her? Ha, ha, ha. Ha, ha. That was a good one. God says, Genesis 18:14, is anything too difficult for the Lord? A young gal named Mary, young teenage gal, a virgin, not married yet, is told she's going to have a baby. Hey, this is a little weird. The Holy Ghost is going to give me... No. And God says, for nothing will be impossible with God. God tells Jeremiah in Jeremiah 32:27, behold, I am the Lord, the God of all flesh. Is anything too difficult for me? See, the strange thing about Gideon is that God makes it harder, not easier. Because in Gideon's situation, and you know what? It's different in all of our situations. But in Gideon's situation, he makes it just downright impossible. He makes it downright impossible. Lest Israel vaunt themselves against me, saying, mine own hand hath saved me. Kind of sounds like God wants all the credit. He does. Well, what's wrong? Why does God want all the credit? What, does he have like an ego problem or something? There's a very good reason why God wants the credit for the things he does. Because he's the only one who can help. I don't know about you, but sometimes I get myself in mildly difficult situations. And I think, oh, God! And then God shows up, God does something, and then I think, I guess I was able to do this after all. I guess I'm not so bad after all. And then I end up taking credit. And the problem with that, it's not like God really is all that bothered. People think I did it. And other people get to thinking, oh, well, I need help. Well, let's go to Almighty Richard. No. Absolutely not. God is the one. God is the one we must go to for help. So God wants to make things absolutely, positively certain. I read a quote from a guy named Dr. Bob Cook. He used to say this. He said, if you can explain what's going on in your ministry, then God didn't do it. How's that? Is that a good one?
Well, tell me, Pastor Richard, why are you so wildly, so wildly successful?
Well, let me tell you the 5-point step process that I've gone through.
No. It's God. It must always be God. We need to make sure that it stays always God who does the work. And so God says, you know, Gideon, you've got a problem. We've got too many people. Verse 3. Now, therefore, go to proclaim in the ears of the people, saying, whosoever is fearful and afraid, let him return and depart early from Mount Gilead. And there returned of the people 22,000, and there remain only 10,000. Now, this is not a good development in Gideon's eyes, I would imagine. This is like a little bit drastic. I mean, they've got 135,000. And we're just now going from 32,000 now to 10,000. Actually, this is something that God has already told Israel that they were supposed to do when they conducted warfare. We saw this back in Deuteronomy chapter 20, where certain people were exempt from going to war. And in chapter 20, verse 8 of Deuteronomy, it says, and the officers shall speak unto the people, and they shall say, what man is there that is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go and return unto his house, lest his brethren's heart faint as well as his heart. We're told why. All of the scared ones were told to go home. The reason is, fear is contagious. Fear is contagious. Have you ever been in a room, a group of people, and somebody says, oh my goodness, was that did an airplane just crash next door? Oh no. You know, just something happens. And we start saying things, hearing things, and then the fear creeps in. It's contagious. It's very easy. I'm scared most of my life. You know, so it's not hard to get it. All kinds of things. Fear is contagious. And so Gideon is told to tell the people, if you are fearful and afraid, go home. Go home. Now, I've been chewing over this thing for a while. And I was thinking about this last week when I was speaking. I don't know if you recall, but one of the points last week was that God uses scaredy cats. God uses fearful people. Because God used Gideon. And then as I was studying this week, I came across this wonderful quote. And I was thinking about, wow, should I make this like one of my major points? This is from G. Campbell Morgan. This guy won like one of the best preachers in the world. This guy is like really good. And this is what he says. He says, the fearful and trembling man God cannot use. The fearful and trembling man God cannot use. And I was thinking about that. And I was going to say that. I was going to say that God can't use fearful people. But I just said last week that he does. And I was thinking about this. And I think that I've come to this conclusion. Mr. Morgan's wrong. And that's not just because I want to protect my sermon from last week. The issue is not whether you're scared. The issue is, will you run? The issue is not, are you afraid? The issue is, will you run away? That's why God says to the Israelites, he says, you know, if anybody's afraid, if you're going to run, let's run now. You get away from us, because when we're in the battle, we don't need the people running away. We need people charging. So if you're going to run, go ahead and go. The issue is not, are you afraid? Because, see, think about it, gang. As you're going to, well, you're going to see more. I'm giving away some of the sermon, but Gideon is afraid. Later on, God's going to say to Gideon, well, if you're afraid, make sure you do this. And you know what? That's what he does. He goes and does his thing because he's afraid. He's still afraid. I'm wondering if Gideon's thinking, wait a minute. What was that? Whoever is fearful and afraid, let him return and depart. Does that include me, God? Can I go home too? But Gideon doesn't go down that road. It's not that he's not afraid. It's that he's not going to run. A senior gas company training supervisor and a young trainee were out checking meters in a suburban neighborhood. They parked their truck at the end of an alley and worked their way to the other end. At the last house, a woman was in her kitchen window and she watched the two men as they checked her gas meter. Having finished the meter checks, the supervisor challenged his younger co-worker to a foot race down the alley back to the truck, just to prove that an older guy could outrun a younger one. As they at last came running up to the truck, they forgot to check who had won because they both realized that the lady puffing and puffing right behind them. They stopped immediately and asked her what was wrong. Gasping for breath, she said, well, when I saw two men from the gas company running from my house as hard as you two. Don't run away. Don't run away. God needs people who, even though they're scared, will stand. God needs people that, even though they're scared, or this group, the most unafraid people who have ever lived. Because frankly, we'd all go home. God uses scared people. God uses people who don't run. So, verse 4. So there's only 10,000 left. And the Lord said unto Gideon, oh, I like this. This is just the perfect size group. No, he doesn't. The Lord said unto Gideon, the people are yet too many. Bring them down unto the water, and I will try them for thee there. Or the word try means to test, to prove, to find out if something's genuine or not. I will test them for thee there. And it shall be that of whom I say unto thee, this shall go with thee, the same shall go with thee. And of whomsoever I say unto thee, this shall not go with thee, the same shall not go. So he brought down the people unto the water. And the Lord said unto Gideon, every one that lappeth of the water with his tongue as a dog lappeth, him shalt thou set by himself. Likewise, every one that boweth down upon his knees to drink. And the number of them that lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, were 300 men. But all the rest of the people bowed down upon their knees to drink water. Now, the idea of this lapping, I don't know. The best that I could figure out what's going on, I don't think he's saying that these guys are going down like a dog. The Hebrew word that's translated lapped here is the word lakak. It's one of those words that the sound, the word describes the sound. That's, you know, that's just the splashing the tongue, dog's tongue makes, you know, in the water. You know dogs, right? They don't say, oh my, what a fine bowl of water. Let me partake of this bowl. And they don't, you know, No. They put their snout in and then they splash like crazy with their tongue and they splash the water into their mouth. I think what's going on here, I may be wrong, but I think what's going on here is the idea, because in verse 6 he described it's not the tongue thing that's the issue. It's that they're bringing their hand to their mouth. So the idea is, just as a dog uses its tongue to splash the water into his mouth, these guys are using their hand to splash the water. So you got two groups of people. You got one group that's going, "Oh man, I'm so thirsty," and they go down on their face, their head in the water, just drinking it in. The other group is down here like this, and they're not bowed down on their knees, so they're just bending down and they're bringing the water up to their mouth. And this divides the group into two groups. There's 300 that do this thing, and there's 9,700 to go in their face in the water. Now, I'm probably thinking, you know, if I was Gideon, I'd be thinking, okay, you want it to be just a little smaller. You probably want the 9,700, right, God? Is that? No, that's not the ones God's going to pick. Two things. Verse 4, "I will try them for thee there. I will test them." Some folks have said, and you know what, there's probably three different views on what's going on here, and so I don't want to make any. Some folks say, well, it really is no reason why God picked one or the other. He was just doing this arbitrarily to pick out 300 guys. No, the word that's used here is that he's testing them. There's a test going on. And the ones that pass the test get chosen. You never know when God might be testing you. This is something only Gideon and God know. And the guys think, hey, okay. Oh, and since they brought him down to the water, I'm guessing, I may be wrong, but my guess is, see, they were up on a hillside. There's the river between them and the Midianites about 4 miles away, and my guess is that they brought them down to the river to do this. They've crossed half of the way to the Midianites. And the guys are thinking, okay, yeah, tomorrow we fight. But... man, I'm just thirsty as all get out. Let's drink, you know. And so they just think we're just taking a break. We're taking a coffee break or something here. But meanwhile, God is testing them. Let's see, which story? Two football players were taking an important final exam. If they failed, they would be on academic probation and not allowed to play in the Sugar Bowl the following week. The exam was fill in the blank. The last question read, "Old MacDonald had a blank." Bubba was stumped. He had no idea of the answer. He knew he needed to get this one right to be sure he passed. Making sure the professor wasn't watching, he tapped Tiny on the shoulder. "Psst, Tiny, what's the answer to the last question?" Tiny laughed. He looked around to make sure the professor hadn't noticed. And then he said to Bubba, "Bubba, you're so dumb. Everyone knows old MacDonald had a farm." Oh yeah, said Bubba. "I remember now." He picked up his number 2 pencil and started to write the answer in the blank. He stopped. Reaching to tap Tiny's shoulder again, he whispered, Tiny, how do you spell farm?" "Oh, Bubba, you are so dumb. That is so easy. Farm is spelled E-I-E-I-O. Oh, well. Let me try another one. This is taken out of Duke University's staff newsletter. Sorry, First Service only got one story. Duke University, there were 4 sophomores taking organic chemistry. They did so well on all the quizzes, midterms, and labs, etc., that each had an A so far for the semester. These 4 friends were so confident that the weekend before the finals, they decided to go up to the University of Virginia and party with some friends up there. They had a great time. However, after all the partying, they slept all day Sunday. Bad guys, didn't go to church. And they didn't make it back to Duke until early Monday morning. Rather than taking the final then, they decided to find their professor after the final and explain to him why they missed it. They explained that they had gone to the University of Virginia for the weekend with the plan to come to study, but unfortunately they had a flat tire on the way back, didn't have a spare, and couldn't get help for a long time. As a result, they missed the final. The professor thought it over. You got to take notes on this one, okay? The professor thought it over and then agreed that they could make up the final the following day. The guys were elated and relieved. They studied that night and went in the next day at the time the professor had told them. He placed them in separate rooms and handed each of them a test booklet and told them to begin. They all looked at the first problem. It was worth 5 points. It was something simple about free radical formation. Cool, they thought at the same time, each one in his separate room. This is going to be easy. Each finished the problem and turned the page. The second question was worth 95 points. It was, which tire? Okay, that's more to the point. You never know when God is testing you. Sometimes we just think, well, this is just a nuisance thing that I'm going through in my life. What if it's a midterm exam and not just a nuisance? Warren Wiersbe writes, I heard about one leading pastor who always took a drive with prospective pastoral staff members in the other man's car just to see if the car was neat and if the man drove carefully. Whether or not neatness or careful driving habits are always a guarantee of ministerial success is debatable, but the lesson is worth considering. More than one prospective employee has ruined his or her chances for a job while having lunch with the boss, not realizing they were being evaluated. A guy named Marsden wrote, this one's worth writing down. Make every occasion a great occasion, for you can never tell when somebody may be taking your measure for a larger place. Say that again. Make every occasion a great occasion, for you can never tell when somebody may be taking your measure for a larger place. I think some of us have tasted that, haven't we? You know, we've gone through difficult times. We've gone through things that, you know, man, I was tempted to run away. And then I found out later it was a test. God was testing me. And so God said to Gideon, he said, you know, you bring the guys down to the river because I'm going to test them there. I want a certain group. Now, verse 7, it says, and the Lord said unto Gideon, by the 300 men that lapped, will I save you and deliver the Midianites into thine hand and let all the other people go, every man unto his place. So the people took victuals, or they shared their food in their hand and their trumpets, and he sent all the rest of Israel, every man unto his tent, and retained those 300. And the host of Midian was beneath him in the valley. Now, the idea is this, is that as he dismisses the 9,700, they share some of their supplies with the 300. So those 300 are pretty decently, you know, supplied, at least for a little while. And God says he's going to use the 300 that lapped. Now, is there significance to the fact that God used the guys that were doing this? Opposite point. But I believe that the significance is the fact that these are the guys whose faces are not in the water. And these are the guys that are watching. I think that's the significance. I may be wrong. And if you want to argue with me, I'm not going to argue, because you can choose another view. But to me, as you look at the story, these definitely need to be vigilant men, because they're going to need to be guys who follow hanging off, looking at other stuff. And so I think that there's a possibility that there might be something to this. And the point is this: God uses vigilant people, or not vigilantes, vigilant people. People who are looking, people who are watching. Peter writes in 1 Peter 5:8, he says, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, walketh about seeking whom he may devour." We are learning as a nation that we need to be vigilant, aren't we? I mean, that's what our president is reminding us. He's saying, look, we need everybody having their eyes open. You know, that's part of the lesson. We're facing the water, but we're aware of what's going on, even aware of the opportunities around us. Are your eyes opened? Do you see what's going on? And there's another lesson. Probably could have been a bigger lesson and a bigger sermon, but this is the point. It doesn't take many. God's going to do a wonderful thing here. You have to come tonight to find out what it is. God's going to do an incredible thing with only 300 guys versus 135. It doesn't take many. Jonathan would learn this a couple hundred years later. Jonathan, the son of Saul, the first king, he had this really strange notion. He's talking to his armor bearer. They're fighting the Philistines, and he was thinking, you know, well, he says here, 1 Samuel 14:6, it says, Jonathan said to the young man that bears armor, "Come, let us go over under the garrison of these uncircumcised Philistines. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for there is no restraint to the Lord to save by many or by few." I read a quote by Warren Wiersbe again yesterday, where he was saying that some churches have this notion that it's only the big churches that God can use. Maybe not. Maybe he'll just use churches that have people who won't run. Pastor Chuck had a quote that disturbs me. I'm not there yet, but this is what Chuck said. Chuck says, "Never worry when God thins the ranks." It doesn't take many. Let's look at one last section, verse 9. "And it came to pass the same night that the Lord said unto him, Arise, get thee down unto the host, for I have delivered it into thine hand." Now, the host, this is a King James word. This is not the lady who serves the coffee and the donuts. Go down to the lady with the coffee and... No, that's not... The host is a King James word that means army. And God is telling Gideon, go. I want you to go spy out. Just you. Just go out. I want you to see what's going on in the Midianite army. Now, keep in mind, these are the days before CNN, before television, newspaper, before photographs, before... people will have heard of Gideon, but they don't know who he is. This is the days before armies had, colored uniforms. The Midianites were not all dressed in, red, and then the Israelites were in blue. No, they all looked the same. Couldn't tell them apart. Couldn't tell them apart. And so he says, I want you to go down and listen to these people. But in verse 10 he says, but if thou fear to go down, if you are scared to go by yourself, go thou with Purah, thy servant, down to the host. And thou shalt hear what they say, and afterwards shall thy hands be strengthened to go down with the host. Then went he down with Purah, his servant, under the outside of the armed men that were in the host. Now, God said, if you are scared, don't go by yourself, go with Purah, your servant. So, does he go with Purah? Yes. What does that tell you, investigators, detectives? He's scared! Okay, got that. Okay, very good. Okay. And the Amalekites and all the children of the east lay along the valley like grasshoppers for multitude, and their camels were without number as the sand by the seaside for multitude. Just huge numbers of them. And when Gideon was come, behold, there was a man that told a dream unto his fellow and said, Behold, I dreamed a dream, and lo, a cake of barley bread tumbled into the host of Midian, and came unto a tent, and smote it that it fell, and overturned it, that the tent lay along. Now, what he's saying is this. See, Gideon just happens to be kind of moseying along the camp, going, Oh, yeah, I'm a Midianite. Oh, yeah, I'm a Midianite. Don't pay attention to me. You know, they're trying to, like, blend in with the crowd. As he and Purah are going along, they hear a guy telling a story. And this guy's telling his buddy, Man, you won't believe it. I must have had too many anchovies on that pizza last night. Or something. Of barley bread. Rolling along. Now, barley is the poor man's grain. It was not, I mean, you know, most people would eat wheat and stuff. You would feed your animals barley. But it was where the Israelites had gotten to, being beaten up by the Midianites all this time. And so it's very, very descriptive of the Israelites. And so the guy has his picture, this dream, huge barley thing, big cake rolling along and flattening all the tents of the Midianites. Well, that's a dream. And his fellow answered and said, This is nothing else save the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. For into his hand hath God delivered Midian and all the host. Now, this is kind of nice, isn't this? Gideon just happens to hear this story. And what did God say? God said, verse 11, Afterwards shall thine hands be strengthened. Amazing coincidence, isn't it? You know, he met the angel. He gave food to the angel. The angel did this thing with the stick, and it all blew up in the fire and the rock, and then the angel disappeared. Well, that's enough to get you shaken up that something's going on, okay? Then God starts talking to him, and he does this fleece thing. And the fleece the next morning is wet, just like he asked. Well, I'm not quite so sure. How about the fleece be dry then? And so the next morning the fleece is dry. Gideon's having all these different things happening. But then God goes and whittles the army down to 300 people. That's not fair. I don't know about this. And God sees this in Gideon and says, You know what? We need one more shot in the arm for the old guy. I don't blame Gideon. I think I would be terrified too. God helps our weak faith. God helps our weak faith. He knows struggle. He knows you question. He knows you doubt. And he wants to help. Jesus had been up on the mountain for a few days, and he came back to find a mess. Some of his disciples had been faced with a demon-possessed boy, and they couldn't help the kid. And Jesus rebukes his disciples for not having faith. And then in Mark 9:21 says, Jesus asked his father, How long is it ago since this came unto him? And he said, Since he was a child, and oft times it hath cast him into the fire and into the waters to destroy him. But if thou canst do anything, have compassion on us and help us. And Jesus said unto him, If thou canst believe, all things are possible to him that believeth. And straightway the father of the child cried out and said with tears, Lord, I believe. Help thou mine unbelief. And Jesus healed the boy. I was asked earlier this week, Is it okay for me to ask God to increase my faith? The answer is yes. Absolutely. Are you faced with challenges? Are you faced with scary things up ahead? Are you a little reluctant? God wants to strengthen your faith. And I believe that if you sincerely ask Him, oh, I believe, you will start seeing things. But let me warn you. You better get ready to step out. God, I'm not sure. I'm kind of scared here. God, increase my faith. You watch. He will do it. But when He does, well, gosh, the next thing we'll do this tonight. Come back tonight. The next thing, Gideon is so charged up. He goes back to the guys and says, it's on, let's go. And he goes and he does it. Don't let what you think is a lack of faith on your part, don't let that keep you from following Him. For some of you, perhaps you've never taken that step of following Jesus in the first place. You're still kind of like hanging around on the outside, asking questions about this Christian thing and stuff. Last week I made a challenge. You know what? Go look into the evidence. There's a lot of evidence. I'm not afraid of anybody looking at the evidence. I encourage you, go do it. There's so much evidence. Man, it'll blow you away when you find out that believing in God is not about letting your head be filled with jelly. You know? You can believe in God and be totally rational. Well, you won't get that looking at me, I guess, huh? There will be a day shown you. And Christians, if you've been reluctant to